by the enemies? What have been their tactics? Intimidation, mocking, scoffing, and even to the point of what? Physical threat. They encompassed the city, and they had every intention of assaulting the city. In fact, chapter 4 and verse 11. They intended on killing the remnant, not just stopping the work, but exterminating them. So that's been the opposition so far. Opposition in today's chapter isn't that same type, is it? It's different. But what I want us to see is that the opposition that he faces in this chapter, although we may say it's more subtle, it's more indirect, that'd be a good way to describe that, it's just as dangerous. And we need to understand that, because it's got great applications for us today. So the opposition was relentless. They never quit. 1 John 5:19, the world lies under the sway of the wicked one. Luke 4 and verse 13, speaking about the temptations of Jesus that Satan put on him. In Luke's account there at the end, it says the devil left him until a more opportune time. So he didn't quit. He lost that particular battle, but he wasn't going to give up and quit. He is the roaring lion, the prowling lion who's seeking someone to devour. And so he had withstood a direct assault. And remember again, how was it that Nehemiah overcame that? He armed all the remnant while they worked on the wall. And they showed their dedication by holding some tool in one hand and what was in the other? A weapon, a sword, of some type of defensive weapon. That showed how serious they were about fighting. And this next attempt is going to be very subtle. And again, I've talked about some passages here in Genesis 3 and verse 1 about the serpent. He was more crafty than any beast of the field, of course representing Satan in that chapter. We are not to be ignorant of his devices, Paul says. 2 Corinthians 2, verse 11. And even the 11th chapter of 2 Corinthians letter, verse 14, Satan transforms himself into what? An angel of light. That's not what he is, but he appears that way. So Satan is not above, or it's not beneath Satan to come at you either way. He'll try through his servants, he'll try the direct assault, which that's done in this book. But now we're going to see something else. It's more subtle. It seems to be something that's good, but Nehemiah saw it for what it was. All right. So let's now look at the chapter. And the first 9 verses we'll put together. Nehemiah 6, starting in verse 9. Starting in verse 1 through verse 9. Again, you see the names listed there in chapter 6 and verse 1. The three primary opponents. What's their names again? Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem. Or Geshem, I think it's Geshem, but whatever his name is. Those are the three. And they observe again, it says, that he made enough progress on the wall. Now, how much of the wall had been done and what was left to be done? Right, was the wall up? The wall was up, but there was no doors in the gates. So it was not totally secure yet, but it's most of the work is done. And when the enemy saw that, they realized that this man is dedicated, and these people are dedicated. And so they initiated another attempt. This is starting in verse 2. What was the communication this time? It's no scoffing. It's no mocking. It's no threat. Yeah, we have some things to talk about. Meet us in the plain of Ono. We want to talk to you. Now, you have an enemy who has opposed you like they've opposed him, and you get that offer. Now, without being cynical, we don't want to be cynical. I think the Scripture teaches the people of God not to be cynical. We want to think the best and believe the best. But we also have to be realistic. So what would you have thought if you were Nehemiah and you got this offer? Probably the same as he thought. Yeah. Now, they're your enemies. And they want to sit down and have a discussion. what would there be to talk about? What would there be to discuss? Yeah, because you know what they want, and they know what you're doing. Now, how can that be discussed? Where is any opportunity for communication in that? There isn't any. So without being cynical, but being enough of a realist, Nehemiah realizes there's something kind of stinking about this. This smells really bad. I'm not gonna fall for this. So through the first part of verse 2, they offer to meet. Look at the last part of verse 2, and this gets us to question 2. What did he know? Just one sentence there. They were planning on what? Harming or hurting him. He saw it for what it was. So he says, what was his response? Now, this is a good answer. He says, no, I can't come to you. I'm doing a great work. And I don't have time to come out to you, because if I come out there and talk to you, what's he say about the work? Yeah, I mean, which is what they want. That's what they want, the work to stop. So if we can get him out here and talk with him, then that'll put a stop to the wall rebuilding. So that's really the idea behind the enemies there. And he realizes that. So the work doesn't need to stop because I'm kind of out there speaking with you. I'm not going to do that. How persistent was Sanballat? Look at verse 4. Well, four times. They sent this offer four times. That's persistence. See, the devil doesn't quit. Well, how persistent was Nehemiah? What's it say? Answered the same way. He sent me their question. I sent the same answer right back to him each time. So that tells us, when Satan's servants try some of these subtle approaches, come meet us in the plain of Ono. Let's have a discussion. What do we need to say? No? Can we not almost quote him verbatim? I'm involved in a great work. I'm trying to do the work of Christ, whether it's in my life personally, or maybe I'm involved in something in the kingdom, and I'm doing something with my brothers and my sisters collectively. I don't have time to stop and go talk to the servant of the devil, because if I do that, then what am I not doing? See, I'm not doing the Lord's work then. I'm off chasing this rabbit and chasing that rabbit, and that's what the devil wants. So we can see that. And that's Nehemiah's principled response. He recognized it for what it was. It was a subtle attempt at a compromise. And this is what I meant when I said earlier. This one is just as dangerous, but it's more subtle. It's not an in-your-face attack, but it can be just as deadly. Yes, Josh, do you have a question or a comment? Well, let me know if you think about it. We'll stop later. Okay. Excuse me. Again, these questions, what was there to talk about? Nothing. What possible good could have been accomplished at such a meeting? Nothing. Well, from Nehemiah's standpoint. Now, from their standpoint, they would have got what they wanted. But I'm arguing this from Nehemiah's standpoint. Nothing good would have come from this. Now, I want to stop here for just a moment and make an application. And I think there's something good for us here to think about. This offer of meeting in the plain of Ono, and I'm going to use that now just metaphorically, that wasn't just for Nehemiah's day. Is the devil still trying to compromise with God's people today? He most certainly is. Now, he doesn't care whether he comes at you with a frontal assault. He'd like that too. But seems like he chooses this method a whole lot more than the more direct attacking method, if you will. You ever had any offers in your, say, in your secular work, say with members of your own family, who want you to compromise on something? Has that ever happened to you as a Christian? Well, it happens. Let's talk about this. You know, sort of leave your hard, rigid position and come meet us halfway. That's an offer to come to the plain of Ono and sit down and talk with the enemy. And what's wrong with that? What's wrong with doing that? You've got to stand on principle. We're involved in great work. And we don't have anything to discuss. Do we? With the enemy. What is there to talk about? We have to do the religion of Christ. We didn't. It's not our will, it's His. And if the Lord says do X, Y, Z, then whether it's your mother, your father, your spouse, your children, your friends, people at work, whoever it may be, and you know you can't budge off position X, Y, Z because that's what the Lord said to do. Well, let's talk about this. I've got nothing to say. What is there to say? If I know the Lord says do it, then that's my duty. And that was his situation here. Absolutely. Oh, no. Can't do that. Hebrews 11, I thought of this just in passing. These verses, of course, describe Moses. When he, by faith, when he had grown up, he refused to do something. What was it? He refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Now that he was living a life of compromise, wasn't he? He was living the life of an Egyptian prince. Now on the outside, I'm sure he looked like an Egyptian. He dressed like one, was educated like one, he was treated like one, but what was he on the inside? He was a Hebrew. And he had to choose to suffer ill treatment with the people of God than to keep enjoying the passing pleasures of sin. He just couldn't do that anymore. So as you go in the story of Moses a little long down the line from there, he becomes a leader then of the people. He leads them out of bondage, but before they're released, remember he has those encounters with Pharaoh over the 10 plagues. This is my favorite passage in the plague story, Exodus 10, 21 through 26. I believe it's the 9th plague. The plague of, is it the plague of darkness? Make sure I get that right. And Pharaoh's sort of been yanking Moses on his chain, up and down. You can go, then changing. Yes, you can go. No, you can't. Yes, you can go. No, you can't. On and on and on. How tiring that must have been to Moses. But here, finally, he says, okay, you can go sacrifice to your God, even take your little ones, but you have to leave the animals behind. They can't go with you. Remember what he said? Not one hoof. See, no compromise. Now, Moses might have thought, this is the best offer I've got so far. And he had several bad offers. But this was the closest one he could have gotten to getting all that he wanted, without getting all that he wants. So he could have reasoned, it might not get any better than this. Maybe I better take Pharaoh at his offer. No, we can't compromise. If the Lord said do it a certain way, then our answer must be as Moses. Not even one hoof. No compromise. It's all or nothing. Now, I think it's a great lesson for us to learn here. Nehemiah is showing us the way. No reason to go out there and talk. We must respond the way he did. Love not the world. We can't be infatuated with the world. There's no room for compromise. And it's just that plain and simple. So Nehemiah's digging his heels in here. And he realizes the compromise, the danger that it is. So after these four attempts, as persistent as Sanballat was, Nehemiah was just as persistent. Well, Nehemiah is not through with Sanballat. He has one more attempt. A fifth time, he sends this message. And what's the contents now? In fact, how is it described in the text? All right, an open letter. Sanballat sends an open letter. Sanballat's a governor, it seems, that's the position he's occupying, of the area of Samaria, which would be to the north. We know Nehemiah is the governor of Judah. Typically, and history tells us this, when governors would send correspondence back and forth, it would be sealed. It would be confidential. So I think I asked you in the lesson, last part of question 5, what is meant by the phrase open letter, do you think? Now, they didn't do email, so. That's right. Whatever route the message would take to get from point A to point B, anybody along that way, they could have read it. Now, why would Sanballat choose? Let's try and get inside his head for a moment. Why would he have chosen that method, do you think? Do we know what the contents of the letter was? What did it say? Yeah, here's what you're doing. You're rebelling against the king. Now, had that been used before against the remnant? It had. We saw that in Ezra. Remember chapter 4? During the days of Artaxerxes, they got the work stopped. All right, so that's been tried before. They're rebelling, and then he got a little more personal with Nehemiah. What else besides they're going to rebel, did he say? And you're going to be, what word did he use? King. Now you're talking high treason. Right? Not just governor, not just leader, but you're going to be the new king. So what would the king back in Persia have thought of that if that were true? You didn't put up with that. That's an uprising, and you squash that right now. So you're going to rebel. You're going to be their king. Everybody, see, and by letting everybody else read this, what is Sanballat trying to propagate and try to further along? And yes, if we get people starting to talk about this and whisper about this and spread the rumor, then if you tell a lie long enough, what happens to it in the minds of many people? It becomes the truth. Not that it is the truth. If it's a lie, it's a lie. But if enough people say it, then he's got momentum on his side. So you're rebelling. Therefore, this is the middle of verse 6. Therefore, you are rebuilding the wall. And according to these reports, you're going to be their king. You have appointed, verse 7, a prophet to proclaim in Jerusalem concerning you, a king is in Judah. And then the next and last part of verse 7, what's going to happen to all this news? And it's going to wind up where? It'll get back to Artaxerxes in Susa. And then you have the offer, last part of verse 7. So what's Sanballat say? Yeah. Sanballat is saying, look, Nehemiah, I really care about you. I don't want this to happen. It's kind of funny, isn't it, Ron? I'm so concerned about you that, listen, we need to talk about this. That's what he's saying. I mean, it's almost laughable. Here's the fellow who's been trying to kill him all this time. Now he's insane. Of course, he doesn't say, but the insinuation is, this rumor is really going to damage your reputation. I mean, it's going to make you look really bad. Now, I can help you with this. But you got to come out here. We got to talk about it. We've got to discuss this over. That's the offer this time. So the letter could have been read by anyone along the way, and it's being delivered. And so the message was the slanderous rumor that they planned to rebel. Nehemiah would be their king. This would get back to the ears of Artaxerxes. And so out of this concern, and it's feigned concern, it's not real, it's not genuine. Sanballat, I want to talk to you about this. Well, verse 8, what's Nehemiah say? He says no. In fact, he says it exists in one place. This rumor does exist in one place, which is where? In your head, in your mind. That's where it is. Nobody else believes this. Why was Nehemiah so confident? I want you to think about this. Why was Nehemiah so confident in not being worried about this rumor? Now give it some thought. Well, he had the Lord. That's the main reason. But what had he done personally? Even who believed in him? That's right. Had he not already proven his character with Artaxerxes? He had. He'd already proven himself. And so if we take the time to invest ourselves in the lives and the activities of other people that we interact with, and we conduct ourselves honorably and godly, all right, will that stop the rumors from being spread? No. People will say what they want to anyway. But if you've already proven yourself before other people, then when they hear this rumor, and of course, I know there's a lot of ifs here, but if they think enough of you, they'll realize what? Well, that's not true. I know him or her to be otherwise because of how he or she has conducted him or herself. You see the point? And that's what we need to do. And I think Nehemiah was thinking along those lines. I do think we have to admit, imagine the pressure to meet. I mean, you start talking these kind of rumors. This is life-threatening rumors. If you rebel against the king, I mean, that's treason, and you get executed for that. So the pressure to meet would have been there. But Nehemiah was equally confident in his standing before the king. He tells Sanballat, "You're inventing this up in your own mind. I'm very comfortable in my standing before the king. He don't see where I am." In fact, if we go back just for a second, remember when Nehemiah asked to go back to Judah to build the walls? Remember some of the preliminary questions the king asked him? That told us, at least a small indication, of what the king thought of him. What did he ask him? "And when are you going to come back?" Now, if he didn't care anything about him, he'd say, "Good riddance, get out of here." But he said, "How long are you, and when will you come back?" So he was a trusted servant, absolutely. Yes, he did. He asked, which was the proper thing to do when going back to such a far place away. That would have given the impression, well, not impression, but it would have stated the fact that the king put his blessings on that trip, and he had royal authority and permission to do what he was doing. So, he recognized this as another attempt to frighten and discourage the workers. And then the last part of verse 9, one short phrase. What's he say? Again, what's he doing? He's praying. He says, "Oh God, do what? Strengthen my hand. Give me strength." Does that admit that this is maybe getting to him a little bit? Well, he's human. A person can only put up with so much pressure, and even a strong, committed person of the Lord can only endure so much. So he's praying for strength. "I need help to overcome this. This is tough." So he asked for help again. So you'll see there at the last part of verse 9, he saw it for what it was. And he deals with this subtle attempt. So what do we learn from this? The world tries to get us to compromise. And the answer must always be what? No. Don't look for ways to rationalize it or justify it, because we got nothing to discuss with the world. We don't have anything to discuss. It's the Lord's way or not at all. And Nehemiah, I think, gives us a great example for that very thing. Okay, verses 10 through 14, we have another proposal, if you will. Shemaiah, whoever he is, if I've said that name right, but he has an offer. What was his offer to Nehemiah? This is on page 34 now, and it's question 8. All right, he wants to talk with Nehemiah. What was he concerned about? All right, a plot to kill you. Now, would that have been believable? I think so, because why? There had been one before. The plot, if you will, or the plan was to have this attack on all sides of the remnant and come in and just wipe them out. So that would have been believable, just on its face, is all I'm suggesting by that. And this plot would have been carried out when? Now, here in this chapter, what's he say? They can come at you when? At night. Maybe even that night. And so, Nehemiah, you need to you need to do what? Hide where? In the temple. In fact, does it say in your version, "Let us meet together in the house of God within the temple, and let us close the doors"? All right. You've got to hole up inside the temple. That's the only place you can run for safety and for protection, because this plot is out there to kill you. Your life's in danger. What's Nehemiah say? Pardon? Yes, verse 11. He asked the question, what? Should a man like me flee? That's not the kind of person that I am. And the offer is, you'll be safe in the temple. Now, had he faced this kind of problem before? Yes, the plot to kill. What didn't he do back then? He'd run and hide then, did he? In fact, what did he do just the opposite? He armed himself. he armed himself and the fellow remnant of Jews for this attack to defend themselves. And so why flee for safety now? He didn't do that before. That's the first thing he thinks. But there's a bigger issue here than just him not running like a coward and hiding somewhere. What does he say? That's the major concern. Yeah, now he mentions the word sin. Is that in your version? It's in verse 13. Is that right? Is it in the King James Version? All right. So what would be the sin? There you go, Daniel. He'd be entering the temple. Now, why would that be a sin? Only the priests could do that. And Nehemiah, as great a man as he is, what's the problem? He's not a priest. You can't go in the temple unless you're the priest. And so he realizes, now, if I do that, in fact, my verse says, if I do that, verse 13, if I become frightened enough, they will have an evil report in which to reproach me. Reproach him in front of who? Would the other nations care where he went? They wouldn't care. It'd be the Jews, his brethren. Because they knew what the law said. And so if we can discredit the leader, now this is important. What if you want to stop somebody from doing something? Well, you can try to stop them by force. Alright, they tried that. That didn't work. You can try to get them to compromise. They've tried that. That didn't work. So now what are we going to try to do? Let's discredit him. Let's make him out to be the man that he's not really, that sort of person. And if we can discredit him publicly, then what about any followers he has? They'll just wither away to nothing. And if that happens, what about the wall work? It'll stop. See, it's everything they do is aimed at the same result, to get everything to quit. So now they're going to try to discredit him. And he realizes what? This man's been hired. He's no true prophet. And the passage is here on the chart. These references back in Numbers. I will have to admit, those all refer to the tabernacle. The law stated about the layman who would come, or the commoner who would come to the tabernacle. How far could he go? But I think the same applies to the temple. Just couldn't find any passages that would say that. How far could the Israelite go to the tabernacle and later on the temple? The courtyard. What was in the courtyard? The altar of burnt offering. And he would bring his offering there to the priest. We know that he could go that far because the law says when he brought his offering there, he would lay his hands on the head of the animal before it was slaughtered. And you got to actually be there to do that, obviously. So you could go that far. But past the altar took you to the structure itself. And the first area was the holy place. He couldn't go there. And then the most holy place, only the high priest could go there. So the commoner, the layman, could not go any farther than the courtyard. So now they're saying, you've got to go to the temple inside the doors and close them to be safe. And Nehemiah, he knew right then, I can't do that. You ever heard the phrase situation ethics? I know you have. What's it basically tell us if you adopt the philosophy of situation ethics? Okay, in certain situations, what would ordinarily be not okay to do would be okay to do in that situation. How many people do you think live by that rule? The world is full of them. And sadly, so do some disciples. So do some Christians. I've actually talked to some who indicated they adopt that particular philosophy because of a certain situation. Now, ordinarily, I wouldn't do that, but in that case, it seemed like it was okay to do. No, we can't treat the will of God that way. It's what it is, and we have to adopt it. And this would be, how easy would it have been to justify going into the temple? Well, it could have been easy if you wanted it to be. You could start talking to yourself, look, if I'm dead, I can't be much of a leader. And if this plot is true, and they're going to come at me tonight, then I do need to hide somewhere. And see, then you start thinking, maybe the temple is the best place to go. And before you know it, where are you? You're behind those doors and you're shutting them. That's what they want. And Nehemiah, again, he says, no, this is not so. And he realizes, verse 13, he was hired. This prophecy was not true. There's no truth to it whatsoever. So it would have brought reproach. His leadership would have been effectively destroyed, and that's true. And the followers, the remnant, would no longer follow a discredited leader. And the work comes to a grinding halt. So there you see. So here we see another attempt. And every one of them had failed because why? One thing they didn't count on. His faith, his commitment, his dedication, his godliness. That's right. I think that's a good way to put that. It was all rooted in his faith in God. And he's just not going to give in and quit. Now, is this just for somebody who's building a wall? Obviously not. You and I can be the exact same kind of person that Nehemiah was. We can. We certainly can. And we need to be. All right. So one more time he prays, doesn't he? Look at verse 14. One more prayer. What does he say? He doesn't say, does he say, remember me? He says, no, remember them. Remember the enemies again. And do what? Remember, O my God, Tobiah, Sanballat, according to these works of theirs. Be mindful of what they're trying to do to me. Please don't overlook that. He also mentions a prophetess and the rest of the false prophets who were trying to frighten him. So he asks God to once again, like his prayer back in chapter 4, he prayed that the Lord would deal with his enemies justly, fairly, due to them that fits their evil deeds against me. That's what he's praying against. So this was his character. We're just not surprised by his fervency in his praying. All right, verse 15. The hinge verse of the whole chapter. What do we learn in verse 15? The walls were finished. How long did it take? 52 days. What's that tell you about Nehemiah and the remnant Jews? Just that one statement. They worked. Chapter 4 and verse 6. What did it say? They had a mind to work. So if they've been successful because of that, they had a mind to work. And despite all their opposition, they've had external opposition. But they also had internal problems, didn't they? They had the internal strife that was threatening the unity of the remnant. So, because of good leadership, what is the formula for collective success? It's got two parts. Where does it start? With godly leaders. Godly leaders. That's the case in the home, case in a marriage, case in the local church, whatever, any collective activity. It starts with good leadership. But you can't have success only with that. What else you have to have? People who will follow, who are together and who will go and who will adopt the plan of the leader. And they've got that here. Nehemiah was such a leader, but the people had a mind to work. And that's why they were successful. So what good can a local church do? What's it going to have? Good leaders. And what about the members who will work, who will put themselves to the work of the Lord? And you'll have success in that, just like they did. It's a good formula to follow. It's an excellent, excellent model for us to pattern ourselves after. I asked in the question, question 11, how long had it been since Nehemiah first heard about the distressful situation? 9 months. If you look at the Jewish calendar, he was told in December. Then in chapter 2, he asked to go back. That was in April. And this is the month Elul, if I'm saying that correctly, there in verse 15. And that's about our September. So it's been about 9 months since he first learned of this distressful situation. Now, the actual work was done in less than 2 months, 52 days. But I wanted to look at it from the standpoint of when he first found out about the bad situation there in Judah. So 9 months later, what he first had been told was distressful and reproachful, he's gotten finished. because of him, and because of the Jews who were dedicated to it. All right, quickly. They become deflated. What's it say in verse 16 when they heard that this had happened? When all our enemies heard of the wall being finished and the nations surrounding us saw it, then what? They were disheartened. They lost their confidence, my version says. The fight out of them was taken. They didn't have any more fight in them. Because they realized what? These people, they weren't going to quit. They stuck to it. And so they lost their confidence. That's how you beat the enemy, is by doing the Lord's work. All right, the last part of the chapter, 17 through 19, we focus on what individual again? What's his name? Tobiah. He's one of the enemies. And he still is sending, he's still sending letters. But what is his situation with respect to the remnant? Now, he's an Ammonite. Okay? And we know where the Ammonites come from. He's not a Hebrew, but there's some connection there. But how was he invested in this remnant situation? Well, he wrote letters, but there's a connection there. Yeah, there was an intermarriage between him and his family with the nobles and the princes. And so he had some inside information. This may have been how he learned some of the things he learned about the remnant, because he had a pipeline in and out. He sent them letters and they would send him back correspondence. And in fact, what's it say in verse 19? Besides writing letters, what else took place among these nobles? Yeah, they sang his praises. They talked really good about Tobiah. In fact, what does Nehemiah write? They spoke good about him in my presence. They said it to me. They want to make sure that I heard what they thought about Tobiah. Well, what did Nehemiah know about Tobiah? He's not that good. I know otherwise. But they made sure to put this more public pressure. They continually praised him to Nehemiah. And Nehemiah writes that he continued to receive letters from them, and he sent frightening ones to Nehemiah. He's not through. He's going to keep trying and trying to discourage Nehemiah from continuing on this great work. Even though the walls are done, he doesn't want to stop his opposition to Nehemiah. All right. We'll come to lesson 15, which, of course, there's no class because of our singing Wednesday. So next Sunday, Lord willing, we'll look at lesson 15, which is chapters 7 and 8. Of Nehemiah. Thank you for your good comments and participation today.